Well, not every place where somebody's doing a radio show tonight can you lead with this, but it's Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett, and my number two son came in from walking the dog about 35 minutes ago, just before the show was getting started, and said breathlessly how he had just seen something that he had always wanted to see, which is at least something unexplainable in the sky. He said, I only saw it for a second, he said, but it was a light that caught his eye. He looked up at it. The light went super bright and then disappeared. And he said, and it was hanging high. I mean, it's not like a street light, not like a plane, not like a, we see a lot of planes in our neighborhood, but it just it went super bright and then just like it turned off. And he said it was in and out in just a few seconds, but it was something he'll never forget. And he's still trying to figure out what it was. I think he was going to hit the books, go online, try to figure out whether there was some supernova tonight or something that he was witnessing. Whatever the case is, he kind of came back a little shook up about it. And I'm just passing it along to you if you happen to be in the upper Midwest and you see something like that tonight. Unfortunately, we won't have a chance to get to open line calls tonight because we've just got so much to get to on the schedule. First of all, I hope you're going to do something nice for yourself this weekend. Find some time off on a Labor Day weekend. I know a lot of us work on Labor Day weekend, but still, somewhere along the line, an afternoon barbecue somewhere that you'll be able to be a part of and find some chance to kick back a little bit. I know it's going to be harder for people in the Mississippi Delta area to do that in many of the southern states, which are currently still dealing with the drenching rains of Hurricane Lee, or Tropical Storm Lee, I guess it was, by the time that it hit the coast and never actually made it to hurricane status. But it was a big storm with major rains and very slow moving, and something in the area of 20 inches of rain expected over a very short period of time over a very large area. And that can add up to problems like we saw last weekend in Vermont, where in areas that you don't necessarily anticipate, the floodwaters can back up pretty fast, can be devastating, can be deadly. So keep an eye on that and just know that wherever you are, we'll keep you company tonight on Coast to Coast with some very interesting aspects of the show. I'd say we have two or three segments to get to tonight. I think you're going to like every one of them. First of all, the president is a sick man. Not this particular president. At least not that we know of. And we would think that we would know if the president were a sick man. But there was a time when that kind of information was more easily disguised from the press. Even a major event like what happened in the book we'll talk about a little bit later on with Grover Cleveland and a special, amazing secret surgery at sea. And then also coming up, the zombie autopsies. Secret notebooks from the apocalypse. You have to hear this show to be prepared for the future. It'll be the final installment of my zombie trilogy on Coast to Coast. Also coming up, if you are a fan of Twilight Zone, like I am, like I know George Knapp is, like I know George Norrie is, then you got to know the fifth season is out on Blu-ray of the Twilight Zone, the classic Rod Serling series. And Mark Zachary is one of the experts on the Twilight Zone in the United States. He wrote the definitive companion guide to Twilight Zone, and he appears all over this special Blu-ray DVD. Got to tell you about it because you have to know about some of the features of this and that George Norrie himself makes an appearance on it, and we'll tell you more about that coming up next. We'll do a little cruise around the news next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. If I sound a little weird tonight, it's because I'm starting the show fighting a major case of the hiccups. Have been for about 20 minutes. Can't seem to get rid of them no matter what I do. So occasionally I just have to turn off my mic when I feel a hiccup coming on. Kill a second or so with the mic switch on cough and then come back as though nothing happened. I tell you that just in case it happens on the air tonight on Coast to Coast until I can beat this, and I'm not having much luck with it. I've tried everything that I usually do. Maybe a good scare will help. How about a 900-foot fall? Have you seen this story yet? We put the car up at coasttocoastam.com. It happened in Austria, or no, sorry, happened in Switzerland with a couple of Austrian teenagers. They fell 900 feet down the edge of a mountain. So they went off the road, a narrow mountain pass at the top of this mountain, and they hit ground several times on the way down. I mean, just like you'd expect if somebody comes down off a mountain. It wasn't 900 feet and then smack, but still, it's 900 feet and only occasionally hitting earth while they're on their way down. And you have to see the car to believe it. It is folded like a jackknife, and both of these kids survived. Not only did they survive, but according to the report that we posted at coasttocoastam.com, both of the teenagers basically walked away with either minor injuries or with a scratch. The car folded up around them in just the perfect way so as to protect them. It became like armor. But when you see the picture at coasttocoastam.com, you realize that that wouldn't happen very often. That might be a one in a million fall from 900 feet down a mountain, but you can see the photo right there. Also at coasttocoastam.com, there's a story of an impossible star that exists in a cosmic forbidden zone. Go click on that and go see kind of, it's almost as though it's being two things simultaneously. That's, you know, not all that surprising for, you know, fans of quantum mechanics and all that, but go see the impossible star exists in cosmic forbidden zone. And NASA to release the Apollo landing site images. This is in response to many people over the years who have claimed that we didn't really go to the moon. Apollo has pictures that they've never released. They've recently found them or some such, and they're going to have a press conference on that. You can get more details at coasttocoastam.com. I sent out on my Twitter feed a little earlier about the movie called The Debt. It stars Helen Mirren. I love talking about movies, so I'll often do that. My Twitter account is Deacon Punnett, D-E-A-C-O-N, Punnett, P-U-N-N-E-T-T, Deacon Punnett. And I was talking about The Debt with Helen Mirren. Also, Tom Wilkinson is in this movie. It's a terrific film based on an Israeli movie. And it tells a very compelling story about Nazi hunting. I'll just leave it at that. But I will say this. I don't know how well it's going to do at the box office. I cannot get this movie out of my head. So I like saw it once in the theater, and I've just keep going over it and over it and over it. Really great imagery, tight script, well-told story. And that is the definition to me of something that doesn't happen very often, where the story is king, as Jeffrey Katzenberg would say. And it is. And that's just what happens when you take a look at the fifth season of The Twilight Zone. The stories are king. I mean, the characters are great. But it's still, it comes right down to, is terrific episodic television writing that's really never been equaled. And the fifth season of The Twilight Zone is just that kind of a trip, where you really go not back in time and see a bunch of actors who you know is bald, but suddenly they have hair, or you know is heavy when they were suddenly thin, etc. But you also see these stories that came either out of the minds of Rod Serling himself, or this sort of cherry-picked group of Hollywood screenwriters that could write something in 22 minutes, which a lot of filmmakers today can't get in 2 hours. And that's why I really enjoyed watching the fifth season on Blu-ray today. Mark Zakri is the author of the definitive guide to The Twilight Zone, the companion guide for The Twilight Zone, as well as being the voice on the fifth season. You can click onto the alternative soundtrack and have Mark take you through the episodes along with some fairly distinguished company, including our very own George Norrie. Good evening, Mark. I'm not hearing Mark. Is Mark there?
Hello?
Did I lose everybody? Okay. So I can't tell whether or not Mark's not there? Well, he was there a minute ago. Now we do. I should mention we do have kind of a new board up situation, and we are breaking in a new person tonight. So maybe there's a button that's not hit, a switch that needs to get flipped. Whatever the case is, we'll check on that. We'll try again. Hey, Mark. And still not on the air, or I'm still not hearing him. And of course, this is happening at just the time that my hiccups are coming back. You know, coming up next week on Coast to Coast will be the anniversary of 9/11, and I've got a very special book on that night with an author who's done some amazing work. Is that Mark I hear in the background?
Yeah, if you can hear me, that's me. You bet.
I can definitely hear you now. Thank you so much. All right, so
I guess I was in the Twilight Zone for a moment.
You were. Tell me about your involvement in the Twilight Zone. How long have you been involved in this series, either as a writer or as a commentator?
Well, you know, it's fascinating because I saw the show first when I was a kid, and it really snared my imagination. And when I got out of college, when I was 22 years old, I knew I wanted to be a writer-producer working in TV, and there were no classes in that. And so I decided I would write a book about, you know, the greatest television show ever made to teach myself how to follow in Rod's footsteps. And so I was literally crawling through Rod Serling's attic, going through his files, watching his own 16mm prints of the Twilight Zone episodes when I was in my early 20s. And then the book came out and it was a huge hit, and off we went. So it's really my entire adult life has been with the Twilight Zone.
You're a Twilight Zoneologist.
Yes, exactly.
Serlingologist or something. You know, Rod Serling was one of those guys who I think we all know. People know the impersonation, even if they don't know why they associate it with horror. I noticed that with my teenagers. They were able to almost do a Rod Serling impersonation, but they couldn't pick him out of a lineup.
No.
But, I mean, it's an iconic voice.
He is, definitely. And the irony, of course, is that he never intended to be the host of The Twilight Zone initially. In fact, the pilot episode was with a guy named Westbrook Von Voorhees doing the narration. He did the March of Time. He had this big, booming voice. It was totally wrong for Twilight Zone. And then they considered Orson Welles, but he was too expensive. And finally, sort of running out of options, Rod said, well, how about me? And they fell out of their chairs laughing, but they tried it. And, of course, he was the perfect choice.
Yeah, it's kind of – I can't imagine that sort of traditional whip pan, right, at the beginning of the show where they whip it over to Rod Serling. I can't imagine – whipping that over to Orson Welles.
No, and in later versions of The Twilight Zone, when they brought it back, they had guys like Forrest Whitaker, and it was just, it really didn't have that same magic, not at all.
No. So, but you mentioned the expense of these episodes, right, that they couldn't afford Orson Welles, and expense really seems to be the downward pressure on The Twilight Zone from the very beginning, that it was really all about making the budgets work, and some of the greatest work that we have up on the small screen now on Blu-ray in the fifth season, it still comes down to the reason why we have the show that we have is because they only had a limited budget to work with.
Yes, it was a TV budget, and every Twilight Zone episode, with a very few exceptions, they were shot in 3 days. And so they had about between, depending on the year of the show, it was between $60,000 and $80,000 per episode. And to put that in perspective, an hour drama now will cost between $2 and $5 million. So it was quite a bargain, and it's really stood the test of time. I mean, these episodes. It's funny. I was talking to someone the other day about television from the 50s and 60s, and most shows, even those shows we all love, they sort of have a creaky, dated kind of camp quality, and not the Twilight Zone. Those, they still hold up. They still really have their edge, and that's really phenomenal when you think about it.
Well, I watched so many of them. I'm a big football fan, and it was really hard today. I was just like, well, I'll pop on a little bit here, and then I'll get back to the game.
Uh-huh.
And like 2 hours later, then I finally get back to watching the game.
Exactly. Because
they're just, once you start watching one, then I went back and I watched it with your commentary.
Wow.
And I think a lot of people would be surprised that the famous Nightmare at 20,000 Feet episode of The Twilight Zone didn't happen until the fifth season.
No, it's amazing because it's as good an episode as any of the five seasons. It's funny because a lot of shows tend to wind down and get sort of tired and full of wind by the final season, but not Twilight Zone. Twilight Zone really holds up. And the amazing thing about that episode was two things. One, it was directed by Richard Donner, who went on to direct Lethal Weapon and the Superman movies and so forth. And also, as I said a moment ago, the Twilight Zone episodes were shot in 3 days in general, but in that one, they were shooting their second day when the studio came to them and said, look, we need this airplane set for extra scenes for a feature we're shooting, and so you'll only have 2 days instead of three. And Richard Donner said, well, then we're shooting all night. And they actually shot that entire episode in 2 days and finished at dawn.
Yeah.
And it's just phenomenal when you think about it.
Well, I enjoyed the commentary of you and Richard Donner, the director, talking about it, because I'll just say this, you wouldn't, but you know or remember as much about that episode as he does. And he, for him, it's kind of a blur. You know, it's kind of another day at the office in a lot of ways. And he can't remember it as much as he could remember about Nightmare at 20,000 Feet, the famous episode with William Shatner in a plane looking out and seeing a gremlin on the wing.
Yeah.
But he did say something that I really liked, and I think you guys both talked about it, is that part of the inspiration for the famous Nightmare at 20,000 Feet is that they had the plane. It wasn't that they came up with this great idea and then they talked the studio into giving them a plane. It was more like they had a plane and they said, hey, write something about this plane, around this plane.
Yeah, well, the amazing thing was Twilight Zone was shot at Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer, and they had access to all of the sets, all the costumes, all the props from every MGM movie or TV show ever made. And so a lot of stuff from Forbidden Planet shows up on Twilight Zone. We have the houses from the Andy Hardy movies and Meet Me in St. Louis. I mean, just it's phenomenal when you really look at it. And so yes, they have that airplane, and it was an actual airplane hung over a tank because it was, you know, simulating a storm as the plane flew through the clouds. It's just an amazing episode, and just, you know, it's just, and William Shatner is great in it, of course. But
he is.
Yeah, but one thing in terms of doing the audio commentaries that was great. You know, I wrote the Twilight Zone Companion, you know, some years ago, and yet when they came to me and said, would you like to produce this Blu-ray set, I said, okay, I'll do 50 commentaries on 50 episodes, and I'll bring people who worked on the original show, but I'll also bring people from the new generation who grew up watching Twilight Zone and love it. So that's how we get, you know, Neil Gaiman and Matt Weiner, who created Mad Men, and George Norrie, as you mentioned earlier. And
right.
So much fun to have those conversations. And also with my own career, where I've written for so many shows like Star Trek The Next Generation and Deep Space Nine and Babylon 5 and Sliders and so forth. Now coming at Twilight Zone, I have the added perspective of having been a writer-producer in television for all these years. And so there's a lot more to talk about with these episodes, even than when I did the book.
Yeah, I could see that. And at least the one of the episodes, I don't know how many he's done, but the George Norrie commentary on the fifth season of the Blu-ray of Twilight Zone, which, by the way, digitally remastered, audio remastered, lots of special pieces that come along with this. It's a really great, I really love packages like this, because I when I sit down to something, I like to really get it, and I really like to sort of understand it, the context, and so this is perfect for me. And I've watched a lot of director audio, sort of director's cut versions of DVDs, like one of my favorite will always be Clint Eastwood doing the alternative soundtrack to Unforgiven.
Wow.
Which is great.
Yeah.
Oh, it's just fabulous. But this is really fun, because you have all these different people. You have all these different voices with you talking about it. And George Norrie on The Living Doll. And that's the famous episode which gets parodied in the Krusty the Clown Halloween special of The Simpsons. It's the one that this is Telly Savalas when he still had a laurel wreath of hair before he shaved it all off altogether. And the famous talking evil doll, which is just great.
That's right. Talkie Tina. And George mentioned that was one of his favorite episodes. So I thought when this opportunity came up, I just reached out to George, who, you know, he and I have known each other for a number of years, and he's such a wonderful guy. And I said, do you want to do this audio commentary? And he said, you bet. Let me add it. And and it was just really fun. And I mean, working on the set in its entirety was just a great joy for me. It was just so much fun to revisit these episodes. And many of them, I hadn't watched in some time, and just to see that they just hold up. They're just fabulous. And
well, it surprised me, actually. I went to the clock stopper episode. What's it called again? The one with
A Kind of Stopwatch. Yes.
A Kind of Stopwatch, which I didn't realize how much that had been that was originally a Rod Serling teleplay, because it got ripped off in that movie Clockstoppers. It got ripped off in the movie Click with Adam Sandler.
Exactly.
It's been ripped off in TV shows. It's been ripped off forever. And that was originally a Rod Serling, almost kind of comic Twilight Zone
it
episode.
It was, and with Richard Erdman in the lead. And again, as you say, there's so many movies that just rip off Twilight Zone episodes. I mean, and some of them are good movies. I mean, a movie like Poltergeist is very, very derivative of a Twilight Zone episode called Little Girl Lost, about a little girl who falls through a hole in dimensions, and her father has to go after her. And And so, you know, you see these resonances and these ripples, and so many film writers and film directors and TV writer-producers grew up on Twilight Zone, and they love it, and it shows in their work. I mean, J.J. Abrams, certainly, Damon Lindelof, Joss Whedon, on and on. I mean, just we all are children of Rod Serling.
Well, this is a graduate study program that you're offering here on the Blu-ray. It's fun to go back and look at not just the fifth season, the final season of Twilight Zone, but also see some of the greatest episodes of all time, which surprised me only in that usually those are the ones that people associate with what made a show so popular instead of what ended up being the capstone of an already popular show. So kudos to you. Great job getting great reviews for the commentary and all the special features for the Blu-ray fifth season of The Twilight Zone. You got to go check out George Norrie's commentary as well. Thank you, Mark Zakrie. And take a look, too, at the Twilight Zone Companion. Find that by clicking on to coasttocoastam.com and following the link for Mark. The president is a sick man, and you don't know the half of it. Next on Coast to Coast. So the zombie autopsies, secret notebooks from the apocalypse coming up next hour on Coast to Coast. We'll talk with Dr. Stephen Schlotzman. He is a Harvard faculty, Harvard Medical Facility faculty member. He is an assistant professor of psychiatry. He has written what may be the definitive book about the physiology of the undead. And we'll talk about that coming up on Coast to Coast. It starts with a diary that was not of his creation, and eventually a diary that works its way into his hands. And he does the commentary on that. And it should be a great night of radio. I hope you'll sit back and enjoy it coming up next hour on Coast to Coast. Mentioned before, there's some terrific links that we put up at coasttocoastam.com. I'm sure you've heard by now how everybody's just about to get a free pizza in the world as they put a Domino's pizza restaurant on the moon. That's in the news box at coasttocoastam.com. Hard to imagine they're going to be able to live up to the 30 minutes or less or it's free, but then again, they may just restrict delivery to anybody living on the moon, which could be happening, at least on the parts of the moon that we don't get to. We can't see. Apollo 18 came out over the weekend, and even though it got some pretty terrible reviews, I was pretty geeked for it. I may end up seeing it anyway. And if you are in the mood for something really good, if you've been watching any of these TV shows that are sort of following along the same lines of, some of the great conversations we've been having on Coast to Coast, know that the new season of The Walking Dead is coming up. They're going to do 13 episodes, I believe, 7 in October, and then another 6 coming up later on, I think, in February. Saw a preview for it the other night, and it's just looking terrific. Coming up next week, the fall of the Twin Towers and the rise of an enlightened humanity. That's the claim of the author of Ego. We'll get to that next week on the anniversary of 9/11. The fall of the Twin Towers and the rise of an enlightened humanity. And it's hard to imagine being in a media age like Grover Cleveland was when he got sick, and what they were able to get away with back then, could they ever get away with it again today? The president is a sick man. Our guest Matthew Algio will join us live from Mongolia next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. Matthew Algio, how is our connection tonight to Mongolia?
I can hear you loud and clear.
Oh, my God. You sound like you're down the block.
Ain't technology great?
It is. Tell me why you're in Mongolia.
My wife is actually a Foreign Service officer. She works for the State Department, and we have been sent here for about 2 years. We just got here about 6 weeks ago, so we're still settling in.
And why Mongolia?
Well, I guess being a Foreign Service officer is kind of like being in the Army. You go where they send you. So we actually did a tour in Rome before we came to Mongolia, so everything evens out.
Okay, that does sound delightful, but it also sounds like the kind of thing you get when you're in trouble, right? When people say, "I'm going to send you to Upper Mongolia," if you do.
No, it's a great job for my wife. She's the public affairs officer at the embassy here, and there's a lot going on in Mongolia. The economy's growing really fast. They have the largest untapped reserves of coal and copper. And, of course, Mongolia is right between Russia and China, and both the Russians and the Chinese want to get their hands on it. So there's a lot of money flying around Mongolia right now.
Well, and technically, though, I mean, are they an autonomous state, or aren't they part of the Chinese?
Yes. Nope. Mongolia, which used to be Outer Mongolia, is an independent nation, and they've been independent for about 100 years now. Inner Mongolia is still a province in China. They split Mongolia. They split it in half. Half of it stayed in China, and half of it became independent.
Well, I imagine if China is trying to get its hands on the coal, then you can be assured that it will be mined with the greatest of concerns for the environment. Correct?
And worker safety.
And worker safety. So we can rest assured on that.
Rest assured. Yeah.
The president is a sick man is your book. So you put out a book, you do a couple of interviews, and then you got to go to Mongolia. That's not always what your publisher would want is. By the way, when the book comes out, I'm going to Mongolia. How did that go over when you told your publisher you were going to Mongolia?
I was still in the States. Actually, my wife had training in Washington for about 10 or 11 months before we came here. So I was able to do some promotion while we were still in the States. So it worked out all right.
And I saw some of it. And what's really interesting about this, the president is a sick man, is not just the story of Grover Cleveland, but it's also a story that many people can relate to. The story of somebody who knew the truth and tried to get it out and was not only vilified, but eventually ruined for doing nothing more than his job as a journalist. It kind of tells the story of the collision of both of these men. First, let's start with Grover Cleveland and what was making him ill.
This would have been in 1893 at the beginning of Grover's second term. Of course, he's the president that served two non-consecutive terms. So he was elected to the second term in 1892. And shortly after he took office in 1893, he noticed a little bump on the roof of his mouth. It was on the upper left-hand side, back near one of his molars. And there was a lot going on in the country. In fact, it's now known as the Panic of 1893. But basically, there was a big speculative bubble. And in 1893, it was railroads. And railroads started collapsing. And the stock market was crashing. And so Cleveland finally had this bump checked out. It was diagnosed as a cancer. It was an oral tumor. And his doctors said that he needed to have it removed immediately. But Cleveland would only agree to the surgery if it was kept secret. He believed that if it came to be known he had cancer, which at the time was pretty much considered a death sentence, that Wall Street would completely collapse and what was a recession would turn into a full-blown depression. And so that's why he decided to have the surgery done on a boat. He had a friend who had a boat, and they went out on the boat for 4 days, and Cleveland just went missing for 4 days. Nobody knew where he was. He sailed from New York to his summer home on Cape Cod, and while they were on this boat, they took out the tumor, most of the upper left palate, 5 teeth, and a piece of his jawbone. So it was a pretty radical surgery.
And did this all at sea?
Yeah, they were on Long Island Sound. The plan was they recruited 6 doctors who were all sworn to secrecy. They all boarded the night before. This would have been June 30th, 1893. And then the next day, July 1st, they set sail from New York City. They sailed into Long Island Sound. And shortly after noon, when they reached Long Island Sound, Cleveland went into the operating room, which was really just a room below deck. There wasn't even an operating table. They just had a chair that they had lashed to the mast in the center of the room. And Cleveland sat in that chair, and they used anesthesia. They used ether, which is a very volatile substance.
Sure.
So it was very dangerous to be operating in a, below deck on a boat with that. The whole thing was pretty crazy that these doctors agreed to do the surgery on a boat and to keep it secret. It was really, they were risking their reputations and their careers, really. But, the surgery lasted 90 minutes. They dropped Cleveland off at his home on the west end of Cape Cod on Buzzards Bay in Massachusetts. And after about 2 weeks, he was healed well enough that he was fitted with a prosthetic device. It was a piece of hard rubber that he could pop into his mouth. Where the hole was, basically, in his mouth, and it plugged the hole, and that restored his natural speaking voice. And the surgery had been done entirely within his mouth. There were no external scars. And so really, after a couple of weeks, everything was back to normal. He was out speaking again, and nobody thought anything was amiss.
Well, you say nobody, but somebody did, right?
Right. And what happened was one of the doctors who had agreed to take part in the operation, he was delayed. He wasn't able to get off the boat in time to for a very important appointment he had with another doctor who was going to administer anesthesia. And this doctor, his name was Hasbrook, when he showed up late for the appointment, he explained himself by saying, well, I was performing an operation on President Cleveland. And I guess that was a good enough excuse. But that was the first time word started to filter out, especially among doctors in New York City. There were rumors swirling that something was seriously wrong with the president and that he had been operated on for cancer of the jaw, this sort of thing. And one of these doctors who heard this rumor had a friend who was the New York correspondent for a Philadelphia newspaper, a reporter named E.J. Edwards. And he told Edwards about this, and Edwards tracked down the source of the rumor, this doctor named Hasbrook, and Hasbrook admitted it, and Edwards printed the story in the paper. It was about 2 months after the operation, August 29th, 1893, and Edwards published a report in the paper. It said, the president, a very sick man. And it really is the most amazing account of the operation and really one of the most detailed accounts of a medical procedure ever performed on a president. But the problem was Cleveland had a reputation for honesty. This went back to his first campaign.
That was the problem. That even though he swore these people to secrecy and was about to perpetrate a lie, he had to maintain the image of the honest man. So he had to lie in order to maintain his image as an honest guy.
It was almost as if Cleveland had built up all this political capital on his reputation for honesty, and he decided to cash it all in on this one big lie. And the policy, when Edwards published the report in the newspaper, the policy, and I found a letter in the Cleveland papers that he wrote to a friend, the policy was not just to deny the story, but to discredit the reporter. They discredited Edwards. Cleveland had friends in the media, in the newspapers at the time, who launched this campaign to basically to smear Edwards. They called him a disgrace to journalism, a cancer faker, a panic monger, these sorts of things. And it practically ruined Edwards' career. I mean, he had the scoop of the century, really.
Yeah.
And nobody believed him. So
it might be Pulitzer Prize-winning stuff today to get a scoop like that.
Woodward and Bernstein, but nobody believed them, that sort of thing. And so that's what happened to Edwards. I mean, this is something that hung over him for the rest of his career. He had been labeled a liar.
And the liar was labeled an honest man, and all of it over cancer that had been successfully treated. Let me go back to something you said before about his concern was that if the word got out that he had cancer, it would crash the markets permanently. Yeah. I mean, like bring him down. Do we think that's true, or was that hubris?
That's a good question. I mean, it probably would have brought the markets down. But in the end, it turned out that the recession of 1893 did turn into a total economic catastrophe. Really, it's still the second worst depression in American history after the Great Depression of the 1930s. So it didn't really matter. In the end, he didn't save the stock market by keeping this thing secret. And, you know, at the time, cancer really was, they didn't even use the word in newspapers. It was called the dread disease. You didn't talk about cancer in polite company. It was so terrifying to people. And it really would have been an amazing kind of courageous thing if Grover Cleveland had come out and said, I have cancer. I have the best doctors are going to operate on me. And, you know, we'll see what happens. And in the end, he lived another 15 years with no recurrence of the cancer. It would have been this amazing public relations victory, you know, a kind of against cancer if he had done that. But he didn't do that. He also, in Cleveland's defense, you have to remember it was about 10 years earlier that Ulysses S. Grant died of an oral tumor. And his death was a big spectacle. I mean, the reporters camped out in front of his house. It was kind of morbid, this death.
But he wasn't president by that point. He'd already written his memoirs. He was already, right? He was drinking on the porch.
But Cleveland didn't want to be the object of attention like that. And, and that was another reason that he decided to keep it secret.
But, you know, the weird thing about that, though, is, and again, we're talking here with Matthew Algio. The book is The President is a Sick Man. And I'm going to read the world's longest subtitle here, wherein the supposedly virtuous Grover Cleveland survives a secret surgery at sea and vilifies the courageous newspaper man who dared expose the truth. Was that the original title? And then they just said, no, that's too long for a title. Chapter. It's not just a subtitle. It's a preface, I think.
If you just would have read the subtitle at the beginning, we wouldn't have had to do the interview at all.
Exactly. It gives it all away. That's why I didn't read it. It's like, oh, it takes all the fun out of it.
We were trying to come up with, you know, one of those Gilded Age being the fair and true story of the, you know, how they had these really long and, you know, windy subtitles. And the funny thing is That's actually the short version. We found out modern databases that booksellers use have a limit on the number of characters you can have in your in your title.
Oh, that's funny.
So we actually had to cut it down.
It would be like calling it The Crying Game, the story of a guy who falls in love with a woman who now turns out to be a guy. Like, okay, thanks. I think I'll skip that movie now.
I'm not giving it all away.
I know. I'm just kidding. But the president is a sick man. It's very interesting. So let's look at this in today's implications for the ability of a White House back in the latter part of the 19th century to be able to hold a secret like that, then for them to be able to manipulate the media like that in order to go against one of their own like this, like they did with this guy who knew the truth. And then on top of that, all of the security issues that come along with it. Do you think a current president would be able to do something like this today?
Well, I'll say this, and one of the interesting things in researching the book was finding out how often this has really happened with presidents who had health issues that were either covered up or denied.
Like Kennedy.
Woodrow Wilson had a stroke with 18 months left in his term that basically incapacitated him completely. And this was all when World War I is ending, the League of Nations vote is coming up. It's a very important time in American history. And he was not fit to be president. But they basically said, he was suffering from nervous exhaustion, which I don't know if that's any better than...
it sounded better back then than it does now, I think.
I guess. So he basically disappeared for the last 18 months of his term. And as you mentioned, Kennedy, and more recently Reagan, we really don't know the extent of the early development of his Alzheimer's disease. As far as just simply not saying a word for 3 weeks like Grover Cleveland was able to do, because back then in the summers, really... kind of Washington just stopped working. Everybody went away. And so it wasn't that unusual for the president just to leave Washington for 4 weeks and really not even say anything. That would be hard to do. I will say this, though. There is an operating theater on board Air Force One. And so it's possible if you had some kind of minor surgery, in some ways it'd be even easier to do it today, on a long trip to, say, if President Obama's going back to Hawaii. It would be a good opportunity to do some minor surgery.
But that would be like a six-hour thing. I think it's just hard to imagine. And especially, if he's going to have like a mole removed or something, who cares, But I think that kind of operating table on Air Force One is really supposed to be if somebody shoots the president, they could get him on Air Force One, get him operated on before they even get him to a hospital, that kind of a thing.
But again, it's just that one of the cool things too about researching the book was finding out this relationship that presidents have with their doctors. And you see this time and again that when the president is the patient, the president is kind of dictating the terms of treatment, not the doctors. And this was a perfect example with Cleveland, where he's like, "Well, I want to do the operation in secret. Let's do it on a boat." And the doctors agreed. I mean, it was the most harebrained scheme you could come up with. But nobody ever says no to the president. So you get these incredible situations where the president, who you expect the president's going to get the best health care in the world, and time and again he doesn't, because people don't give him the best advice.
It's such a fascinating story.
I want to say one quick thing about that Harding. When he was president, he had terrible congestive heart failure. I mean, he couldn't sleep lying down because his heart was too weak to pump the blood out of his lungs. But his family physician was this guy from Ohio, his hometown, who he'd known since he was a boy. The guy was a homeopath, didn't really know much. He liked to prescribe pills by color. And so when Harding wasn't feeling well, the doctor might say, "Take two pink pills." That sort of thing. I mean, he was getting the worst health care you could imagine, and he was very, very sick. And, of course, he died in office.
That's not medicine. That's M&Ms. That's just. Let me ask you real quickly about then the fate of the man who dared expose the truth.
Edwards was called a liar, but one of the doctors who'd taken part in the operation always felt badly about the way Edwards had been mistreated, and so in 1917, 24 years after the operation on the yacht, this doctor finally published a true account of what had happened in the Saturday Evening Post, of all places. But this finally vindicated Edwards, who was still alive at the time. Cleveland was long dead. He died in 1908. But Edwards was still alive, the reporter, and this doctor, Keene was his name, from Philadelphia. He was alive as well. And so Edwards was ultimately vindicated, but it took 24 years for that to happen.
Very interesting story, and not just of a president's power of the past, but also of what it would have been like to have been the person who knew the truth and tried to have it published, only to have his life ruined for it. The president is a sick man. Matthew Algio, enjoyed you quite a bit. I don't know how this will come up again in the news, but somehow I think it will, where somehow we'll get a story again about something that a politician will attempt to do today, and it'll make the story relevant for another future conversation. So if you don't mind me, you know, we'll keep your number in Mongolia handy. Is that all right?
I am standing by.
Okay, very good. Now you can go back to your yurt and have a terrific night. Thank you so much. It's Coast to Coast AM. The Zombie Autopsies, Secret Notebooks from the Apocalypse. You have to hear this story to believe it, coming up next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett.